Hey, everybody, in this episode of I Talk Movies, we're getting up close and personal with writer, director, and producer Brad Epstein. Let's do it.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's I Talk Movies.
All right, Afroman playing us in here to this episode of I Talk Movies. Welcome, everybody. Of course, this is the show where we get up close and personal to the people both in front and behind the camera. They bring you all that great entertainment that you're watching on a movie screen, at home, on your TV, or perhaps on a mobile streaming device. I'm your host, Frank Moran. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at HappyGoJackie. Now, my guest today is a writer, director, and producer. They call it a triple threat here in the business. He's produced films like About a Boy, Dan in Real Life, Ghost of Girlfriend's Past. Now, though, he's taking it all under his own control, and he's doing a film that's just coming out called Ripped. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Brad Epstein. Brad, welcome.
Thank you.
Yes. So, as you mentioned, you're a Los Angeles native.
Yes.
Yes. So, you know, I guess the joke is always like, you know, how often do you find a true Los Angeles native? There's so many, yeah.
Very few. There are very few of us left.
A dying breed.
A dying breed, for sure. Absolutely.
And so, you said you went to Fairfax High. So, did you kind of grow, you grew up right around that area?
I grew up Hancock Park area, first in Mar Vista. And then we went to Hancock Park, and I went to Fairfax High. Demi Moore was a year ahead of me. I was with the Red Hot Chili Peppers. They used to be the garage band. Not, you know, Flea wasn't there, of course. He was somewhere else, probably in juvie. But, yeah, they were the garage band or something. You know, the band that used to play at lunchtime or something like that. We had those. What, it was L.A., man.
Yeah. Wow. What is it like, though, to know that, you know, I saw Red Hot Chili Peppers before they were anything.
They were crap. I thought they were crap. Boy, was I wrong. So, I love them. They're one of my favorite bands, but yeah.
But back at the time, you and your friends were like, who are these guys? Why are they playing at lunch? Get it.
Exactly. Yeah. We want to go smoke weed, and these guys are like,
So right from the get-go, was television and film, was that something that you were interested in right from the beginning, or did you kind of grow into that a little bit later?
You know, my stepfather, who's basically my father since I was five, he was an agent at William Morris close to 40 years, a literary agent. He represented like Oliver Stone and Gene Kirkwood, the people that did like Chorus Line and stuff. So I was exposed to that, but I was one of five kids. All the other ones were smart enough to stay out of the business, and I foolishly started to get, I was interested in it. And the image that I had that I really remember that I wanted to be, this is going to be crazy for it, but Century City wasn't as big as it is now, right? It was very small. It did have like a May company, you know what I mean? Yeah. And maybe like two other restaurants, but it was mainly office buildings. It wasn't really an area. And they were shooting a scene, and I can tell you the scene, and it was from Return of the Planet of the Apes. You know, the Planet of the Apes, and they take over, they finally escape, and then the last one's Battle of the Planet of the Apes. But it was actually seeing the scene where the apes were, you know, being servants and all that, and within, you know, the all-American human population and all that. I remember seeing that scene. I was just, like, fascinated by the whole world. And that was really, for me, I was like, wow.
Now, as you decided to express an interest in that, you know, your stepdad, you know, being so familiar with the business, he's like, sure, go for it. He's like, what are you thinking? Please, Brad, do something else.
Oh, everything. I mean, it was just everything. I mean, oddly enough, they had a party. I did one acting stink, which was quite funny. That my parents, they had the William Morris agency, they had a party at our house, and one of the agents, his name was at the time was Ed Bondi. He's no longer with us, but Ed, you know, thought I was this cute little boy, and I was, you know, at the time 15 years old, and he said, you know what, there's this director that's really looking for an unknown for this movie. You got to go see him. Right? I'm like, okay. Didn't tell my parents or anything, right? Riding my bike up to Sunset Boulevard, right? And then there, I go into this room, and it happens to be, what was it? Endless Love.
Wow.
Now, it was Franco Zeffirelli that was in there, and I was a kid. And I'm like, you know, hey, dude. You know, this Italian guy speaking, and I don't understand him. And he's just like, okay, stand up. And it was my first time experience, went in and saw them, and he thought, you know, okay, might have something, but I lost out because Brooke Shields then got the role, and I was a little too small for.
Oh, man.
But I'm glad I'm not an actor.
Was that kind of the moment that made you decide, like, maybe I'd rather focus on stuff behind the camera as opposed to being in front of it?
No, I went to Emerson College, and then at Emerson College, it was really where I got my legs of really understanding producing. I did the comedy workshop there. You know, Dennis Leary was my comedy teacher at the time.
Yeah, seriously?
Yeah, and Anthony Clark, the actor Anthony Clark, yeah, was in there. You know, Max Munchnick, that created Will and Grace.
Wow.
So, Max was a year behind us. Anthony was in the same year as me. Laura Neitlinger, a comedian. So we had to do stand-up comedy and all that. But we also had a thing called the Emerson Comedy Workshop, where I produced all, you know, these kind of skit shows in college at the time, which was a little bit ahead of its time, you know. And we also had the use of studios there, and this was when MTV was coming around. You know, MTV turned on, I think, in 81, if I'm correct, and we had this thing called Emerson Independent Video. Shout out to Maria, I think she's an Emersonian, right?
Yeah.
All right, so we had this thing called Emerson Independent Video, and we would, so we had, this is 3/4-inch tape, right? 3/4-inch tape and all that. But we had cameras, we had a studio. So I came up with this idea that after school ended, we should go shoot videos and charge the bands. So I got the Del Fuegos at the time.
Wow.
You know, but, and we, I made this video, you know, and that was kind of, that's where I started to get into more of the production of it and loving all that stuff and doing that. And so the rest, and then I got into internships working at Warner Brothers and stuff like that.
Wow. So, because you're thinking about like maybe UCLA or USC in terms of like film school, something like that. And you're like, nah, I'd rather pursue something, get out of here, go to Emerson.
Have you met my folks? First of all, they don't like me, and no. I was fortunate enough, you know, they said go anywhere and all that. It has to be at least 1,000 miles away from us. Now, I wasn't the only kid. That was all five of the kids, okay? So it wasn't just like that. I went to, you know, somebody said, oh, you should go to Emerson. I didn't know where Emerson was in Boston, there I ended up. And
wow. So what was it like moving? Did you go by yourself? Did you have any kind of support
system? I went by myself, zero support. Let me tell you, my folks, folks, we love them, but it's like, it's practical jokes all day long. Yeah. You know, we live next, my stepfather's Armenian, and the Turkish council moved in next door to us, right, when we were in Hancock Park. So when we used to go gardening, he's like, throw the snails over into the Turkish Turkish tennis court and stuff like that. So
was that something that would be able to be so far away and kind of be on your own really for the first time? Was that an easy adjustment to make?
Well, I had fortunate enough, you mean be away? No, my parents sent me to Africa at the age of 13. I was in the,
Really?
Yeah, I was. I got the opportunity to work at the American Institute for Foreign Study. I was 13 years old, living on the slopes of Kilimanjaro. On the slopes of Kilimanjaro on the Kenyan side. And it was time when the East Africa was splitting up, and you had Idi Amin and you had Uganda and all that. So we couldn't go that way. So I got to climb Mount Kenya at 13. And so I got these opportunities of independence at a very young age. Following year, I climbed Cheops with my sister illegally in Egypt when I was 14 years old. Ambition was always just insanity.
How do you, I mean, in terms of doing a scaling a mountain that's considered illegal, like, is it easy to do that? Is it,
what do you
like,
mean illegal to
do it? Or you say, like, is you're saying it's, yeah, it's
scaling. It's illegal to climb up. At the time, it wasn't really illegal to climb Cheops, which was one of the 7 wonders of the world at the time. But I think now you could lose a leg.
Ah, gotcha. All right. Okay. Man, that is incredible.
Yeah.
Wow. So to be able to have an opportunity to do so much of that traveling, going to Boston, yeah, that's, you know.
Boston was great. I mean, that's when I really got my comedy legs. That's where I realized that I want to make people laugh. The joy of making people laugh is the greatest thing for me.
Is the challenge when you want to do that to find out what your sensibility is? You've been influenced by so many things growing up, kind of taking what you've learned and been inspired by all those people and then kind of figuring out, like, but what's my approach? What's my viewpoint? So I'm not feeling like I'm just emulating, but I'm also contributing something that's really essentially mine.
I think the one thing I've always learned, and it was really kind of, you know, more from like watching movies like Broadcast News, you know, James Brooks kind of movies. And I was my stuff I've always wanted to look at life in a comedic way and kind of ground moving forward. My stuff is more grounded in reality, and then you can, your characters, and then you can just take them into a million different directions. And I like to ground it in reality, something real. If the subject is something, if you're dealing with a couple, what is that? What's their issues and stuff like that, real issues. And then how can you make it funny. Because I do like to tap into uncomfortable situations.
Well, sir, I feel like that's if you, I don't know, I enjoy that so much because I mean, the reason it's so uncomfortable is because it's so, I feel like it's so true. And so we can easily relate to that. And nobody really
wants
to.
That's really what I want to do is make universal themes. You know, I got to work with Robert De Niro for 10 years where, you know, I worked on anything from Marvin's Room all the way. I produced About a Boy, but we had done, you know, Ronin and was there, Analyze This, Meet the Parents. So I was able to really get a fantastic education. I mean, look at the people that wrote Analyze This and Billy Crystal and all in the director and the... And it's just, I mean, it was just amazing to be around that crazy talent. I mean, the one person I would just kill to be with and just love to spend a day with would be Mel Brooks.
Well, that, wow, what an opportunity. Yeah. Just the fact that he is, we're fortunate to still have him around. Yeah. And Carl Reiner.
Yes.
Yeah. That is incredible. So on an opportunity like that for like Analyze This, when you've got Robert De Niro and Billy Crystal,
right?
You know, very accomplished in two different kind of aspects, though.
Right.
But when you're working on something like that, are you just kind of cherry picking both of them for different things?
I'm just soaking it all up.
Yeah.
I'm just soaking it all up. Even, you know, I mean, when we did Wag the Dog, Barry Levinson, and all those, and Dustin, and Bob. That it was just you learn so much by just observing these people.
Oh,
and
right.
I just wanted to find. I want my comedy, and you can't. You know, Ripped is more of a hyper thing, you know, kind of thing. But it's a starting point to where you. I really want to make people laugh through something that's relatable.
So I actually one thing you mentioned Dennis Leary was one of your comedy teachers. What is it like having Dennis Leary as a teacher? Because I mean, he feels like somebody.
Dennis was like, if you don't like fucking smoking, I'm going to smoke in this class. Get the fuck out of here. Like that was Dennis, you know? Okay, and he was brutal. He was fantastic, but he really was a lot younger then too. You know, he had just I think finished his first tour, kind of the smoking tour. I think it was that he had done. There was a big yeah. He was fantastic, and he taught me to be fearless.
So for you, do you appreciate having somebody like that that is going to be brutally honest with you,
yeah.
Or do you still want to have, because I know some people respond to brutal criticism, and some people want some kindness mixed in with that.
Well, with a brutal, of course I want a little kindness.
Yeah.
I mean, we all like
it. Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to beat me, come on, just give me the tissue at least to clean up. Yeah, I like brutally honest. I like being challenged. I really, really do. I want to be the dumbest person in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to be collaborative. You know, you hire people that you believe in. If it's the screenwriter, you have those conversations, but you have to, you're really respecting those people. Now, unfortunately, I was a screenwriter in that one, but I've worked with other people that aren't me as screenwriters, you know. So
going into there, did you already have kind of a tough skin kind of developed, or did that really being in that sort of environment over at Emerson really kind of help develop having more of a tougher skin in terms of just like people being brutally honest, you know, just, you know, being fearless?
I think it came later. I think we were all very competitive at Emerson and trying to do the best that we could because we really loved, it was an art school, really. I mean, think about it. We had our own TV studios. We had our own film equipment. We could do whatever we wanted. You know, it's still probably one of the number one broadcast journalism schools in the world.
Did you do any improv out there, or is it more just...
We did improv, too, yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm the worst improv. I'm just like, But I do love it. I have a lot of respect. And that, and even Russell and, you know, Faison, you know.
Yes. So when you finish school, do you decide to stay out on the East Coast, or do you come immediately back to Los Angeles?
I came back here, and my first job was working with John Peters and Peter Guber.
Whoa.
Yeah. So.
Man, that is awesome.
Oh, well.
Well, okay. I mean, yeah, awesome because just the historical
kid, come here. And it was like John Peters screaming at me, go get my car, you know, filled and go take this envelope and go pick something else up, you know. But it was fun. His car was a Ferrari, and I used to get into that Ferrari.
Jeez.
You know, get in the second gears and all that. But, yeah.
So.
That was during Rain Man. We had Rain Man, Clan of the Cave Bear, what was the Revenge of Billie Jean King? I think it was Helen Slater or something. Or Billie Jean King. That's
the tennis.
The Revenge of Billie Jean King, the tennis player with her tennis racket. No, it was like Helen Slater. She was Supergirl.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wow. So coming out here, working on these films is like actually getting a chance to start getting some inroads into an industry you're really passionate about.
Right.
Is it exactly what you thought it was going to be, or it's like, oh man, being the low man of the totem pole is even worse than I thought it was?
It was great. I mean, it was, you know, I mean, I did every, I mean, I was Jamie Foley's assistant. He called me at 2 a.m. coming back from, I was working on Who's That Girl, and I was his assistant, and he's out of his mind going, get over here. It's like 2 a.m. I'm like, why? He goes, my house smells like a skunk. I'm like, well, what am I going to do? We're going to find the skunk, you know? And 2 a.m, I'm under his house, and I found that dead skunk with maggots. I'm like, yeah, there's a dead skunk here.
Wow. I imagine moments like that, you think like, this is my life now. I'm just doing bizarre things like this, and this is really cool. I really like it.
Yeah, I mean, it was fine. I mean, I got you pay your duels. You know, yeah. I didn't make anybody that's ever worked for me do that stuff, but we do laugh about it. And I still see Jamie. You know, and we laugh about
we're
it.
Still, remember that time you become
that time we the skunk.
So as you start working on some of these productions and you start seeing how people are running this, do you start feeling like, you know, I kind of like, as you're kind of mentioning cherry picking, kind of think like, if I have the opportunity to produce, write, or direct, I want to do more stuff like this, or this is definitely stuff that, this is not how I want to run a production. I want to kind of take, not do that, but I want to do more of this stuff.
You mean from my point of view?
Yeah, from your point of view, yes.
I mean, I took a lot, I mean, I took a lot of what I learned and then added my humor and my style to it a little bit. And I'm still exploring that. I think if you were to say, where do you want to go as a filmmaker? I'd say, I want to be Richard Curtis. I want to do movies I produce more of about a boy. I would say Four Weddings and a Funeral is one of my favorite, you know, movies.
Oh, is this like a for Love Actually?
Love Actually.
Yes.
You know, I love those I love those British comedies. I do. I just, they're nuts for them.
What do you think in terms of sensibility between an American comedy and a British comedy?
I think the British comedy, I think they're more relaxed in Europe. You can say a lot of words that you just can't say here, you know, because you'll get hell for it. You know, I've received hell for a little bit of the stuff I did in my movie. But, you know, something I learned is if you're going to go for it, and this is, you know, every comedian I've talked to has kind of said, you just got to go for it. You're going to get hit. But if you score, it works, you know, so don't. You got to be a little. You got to be fearless if you really want to go for it. Be fearless, take the pounding.
Is it easy because you're in the front. You're leading everybody,
right?
Cast, crew. You're in the forefront. They're all looking to you. But is it for those times when you're having maybe that moment of like, oh man, what am I doing? Who do you turn to like, oh man, I'm working on this and I'm making the right choice, or do you just kind of keep your own counsel?
I keep my own counsel, but I rely on my producer. I have a woman producer by the name of Suzanne Weinhardt, and she keeps me in line. You know, she's also a veteran of it. She's a storyteller too. She's a producer. She worked, you know, ran Julia Roberts' company for years in New York. So she's got her pedigree, and she knows how to handle people like us. You know, and going, you know, losing it sometimes. So yeah, she was. She's my counsel. She's my counsel. I do a lot of counseling before I shoot the movie. Meaning, like, when I give the script, I do a roundtable with comedians and writers, and we just sit around and we throw jokes around and we do that without any actors in the room. Like, I'll do that twice, maybe three times, and you know, you pull, you know, get 2 more, 4 more, 5 more, 10 more jokes. It's fantastic. So I like to hire people that are collaborators that challenge me too. My casting director, Edie Belasco, God bless her. Like, she's told me I'm a fucking idiot to my face. I'm like, well, okay. I mean, she is right. I mean, I do. I can even say I'm a fucking idiot. I don't know if I'm allowed to say
please,
that
absolutely. Right. Okay. And is it just in terms of who you're looking to cast, or just the script that you
just
have?
Just me personally.
Just you.
Just my personal
Brad,
life.
You're a big effing idiot.
Casting.
Yes.
It was a casting. We had a big issue. She was very, very helpful to me on casting the younger guys, the played phase on and all that.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of talent out there to find out. And
oh man,
she had said some things to me. It was like, basically, are you a fucking idiot, Brad? And I'm like, okay, you're right.
Just
and
in terms
right.
Like, these are great. Well, why I'm bringing you some great folks. Why are you just not even?
Oh, I'm open to it.
Yeah, okay.
I'm having the conversation. I love the conversation. I love the collaboration. I love all of that. But at the end of the day, I have to make that decision because I'm the director. But I'm open to it. And I hope, and I know that I have changed my opinions on things because of the people, just like the DP, just talking, and you know, that's all the collaboration, because I want to get all that going now. Now, obviously, every day something changes, you know, on the set, yeah. but you can be as best prepared. So it's like when we're shooting things, I would say to the DP in prep, like, we would, what's the funniest shot we can get here? What's the thing, you know? And then of course on the day, but we have that collaboration. We talk about it, and we go, no, yes, no, and then we. Then you have to make that decision.
I guess is the best way to have a set is that you want to have talented people that will kind of push and challenge you, but when a decision needs to be made, they're all going to follow your lead.
Yeah.
Is that an easy thing to achieve on a set, or is that a difficult thing?
Yeah, I mean, if everybody's respectful, yeah. I think if everybody understands their situation, absolutely.
So, as you mentioned, British comedies. One of the earlier films that you produced back in 2002, about a boy.
Right.
So, getting a chance to somebody who's grown up, you know, loving British comedies.
I married a Brit.
Too. Really?
My first wife was British. Yeah.
Oh wow,
that was a mistake. Not. I love Brits. Yes. But, you know.
Did you get a chance to live in the UK for a while?
I was in the UK a lot, in the Manchester area, so northern part.
Oh, wow.
But I couldn't understand my father-in-law half the time.
Right.
Another beer. Cheers.
I've been over to the UK a few times, and I love the other place, but I've always thought of, like, it'd be cool to live here for, you know, a certain chunk of time.
Yeah.
For you when you were over there.
I was able to live a chunk of time. I also, when I was at Tribeca, worked with Queen. I did the Queen musical. I was developing the Queen musical with them. That was called We Will Rock You, and now... I think they're finally going to do it as a movie.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because, that's like, because I always know, like, when they're trying to do like a Freddie Mercury.
It was a Freddie Mercury story. It really is a Freddie. It's a fascinating story.
Because I know it was like Sacha Baron Cohen.
Sacha, which I thought would have been great. But I don't know where they are right now with that. You know, the musical, originally the musical was really dealing with Freddie and hiding his identity. You know, he was Indian. He was Bangladeshi, I think, or something. And, you know, he changed his name from Farooq to Freddie. He hid his gayness for a long time. So that was dealing with that and the woman that he had in his life originally. So it's a pretty heartfelt, crazy story. So I hope they stick to that, and more so than what they did with the musical.
Wow, that's but I mean, we'll be able to listen to some Queen music. I mean,
hang out with them. What, are you kidding me? I got to hang out with Brian May. Are you kidding me? Yes, Roger.
Man,
well, Deacon never comes around very. Deacon's like, he's got some chicken farm that he hates fame. He absolutely hates fame.
Really?
Yeah. So he could care less about rock and roll.
But the other two are like, hey, no, we still like to be involved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, they're very involved. Yeah, yeah. Fascinating, really kind, beautiful people. I mean, to hear their stories and to see what Freddie Mercury went through. You know, when he sang Who Wants to Live Forever at Live Aid, you knew that he had AIDS. So just think, if you watch that now on YouTube, see how powerful it is.
Man. Was living in the UK what you thought it was going to be, or is it like
the best Chinese food, the best Indian food? I just don't understand why they can't get it right here. They can't even get it right in New York when I lived. I just want some good Chinese food, like, you know, from London. So if there's any people out in London, ship it here to me, please.
So even out here in LA, you cannot find good Chinese food.
No.
Is it a constant search?
Or no, it's like, no, no. I'm not that obsessed. No, I just go to Genghis Khan that I used to go to all the time. You know,
It's inferior, but I'll eat it.
Yeah, I've lost that battle. I've accepted the American Chinese, and it's sad.
That day when you have to just come to a, yep, all right, I guess I have to just give up this dream.
Yes, move back to the UK.
Would you ever want to move back?
I would, well, I have three kids right now, so I think, yeah. I mean, I love the UK. I think we'd probably hit New York first.
Okay.
You know, slowly get that way. I love Europe, so I could live anywhere in Europe. Oh. Most of my other movies I'm taking to Europe.
What a great idea. So
written as Bakersfield, California. I just wrote South of France. Yeah,
we were heading.
South of France. I know it says Bakersfield, but we're going to
better. Nope, I need this area. Yes. Trust me, it's going to work out much better.
It's going to work much better. Much better than Bakersfield.
So now you get a chance to work on About a Boy.
Yeah.
And what is it like working on that production? You get to work with Hugh Grant? You get to work with...
It was great because, you know, first of all, I mean, that was a crazy journey. The book originally was Nick Hornby. Mm-hmm. Great writer, right? No, we stole the manuscript. We had the, you know, manuscripts in New York and trying to get... During that time, it was really everybody was... It was almost no, it started the internet. Yeah. And there's so, but you weren't getting PDFs, you know, you weren't. So we were get, we would have, I had people like that would steal manuscripts off of publishers and stuff like that. That was part of what the development crew did. You know, you take the girls that work out at the publishing place, get them drunk and they like you. And then the next day you get that manuscript that you're not supposed to have. And, unfortunately, Scott Rudin and Harvey Weinstein also had that same ploy because they had the manuscript at the same time. So the agent, Jenny Cosarato in the UK, who repped Nick at the time, actually never sent the book out, and it sold for $3 million.
Wow, man. To,
and New Line at the time had bought it. And they didn't read it. Mike DeLuca didn't read the. It was just me and Lynn Harris at the time that had read it. And it happened to be my birthday. So Mike called me and said, happy birthday.
It's like, you. All right.
For, not a tie, no tie.
For you, I mean, one of the two people that kind of read the script. I mean, are they,
is it was Mike, a book, manuscript.
A book, yeah. But they're looking, is Mike DeLuca looking at you like, all right, Brad, do you think this is something that we should
I think
really
he was
pursue?
Looking to his executive who, you know, Lynn, and Lynn was like, are we, is this crazy? I mean, it started, it was like 1 million. I'm like, oh, well, 1 million, right? And then she called me back. She's like, Brad, I'm like, what? She goes, we're at 1.7. I'm like, 1.7. Okay, yeah. She's like, you still feeling good about this book? I'm still feeling good about this book, right? And then it got up to 3 million, and we took it. And then New Line put it in turnaround when Mike left, and it went over to Universal, and there it got a Universal with working title.
Oh, man.
So it all worked out.
So another film that you worked on, Ghost of Girlfriend's Past, you get to work Michael Douglas on that film. For right. somebody else, like very much like Robert De Niro, who's been involved in right. a lot of different aspects of the industry,
right.
what's an opportunity to talk to Michael Douglas, kind of just hear a lot of his experiences?
I mean, he's just a generous sweetheart. I mean, he was just a really, really nice guy. He's obviously talked. I mean, I knew a lot of the people that he knew because of our, you know, his family and stuff like that. So it was, and he knew that I had worked with Bob before, so... We had some interesting stories to talk about, which was fun. But he's a fascinating guy.
Just the projects that he's been involved with, and just the family that he's come from. Just I'd imagine, just so many endless stories that he could
yeah.
share.
Oh yeah.
So when does the idea come from? Like, you know, I just want to just be producing films, but you know, you've been as talking about back in Emerson, always being involved in creating stuff as well.
Right.
Thinking like, all right, producing is great and being involved in these projects, but I actually want to be the one that's calling the shots, writing a script, directing it, and bringing it to fruition.
Yeah, I mean, look, I was a studio executive. I had studio gigs. I had as it's easy to be a producer with a studio deal. You know, Tribeca, we had a studio deal. Carte Blanche, you know, credit cards, everything. You know, it was pretty incoming business, right? And that as a producer is a much more is a bigger strength, and there's a lot more say. When you become an independent producer and you're scruffling along, everything changes, you know, and you have to you don't have any of those luxuries. You're not getting as a producer, you're you know, as an overhead producer, you're getting paid. As a independent producer, you don't get paid until the first day of shooting. Right? You know, so you're developing, you're doing all these things, and there were a couple projects. One in particular that just irritated the shit out of me, and it was becoming I realized that the producer, the independent producer to the studio producer, much huge difference, and you just don't have that creative control as much, and trying to control the director and trying to just get everybody to stay on schedule. Now again, none of these in a studio situation, people are getting holding deals and stuff like that. When you're in the independent world, you don't have those holding deals. You don't have anything until really everything comes together and boom, you're shooting the movie and then you get paid. So my frustration was when I started to do some independent movies. There's one movie in particular where it's still not made to this day, right? And it should have been made. And it was because the director kept going off and doing these little TV, not even, it was just a TV show. He wasn't show running. It was just a TV pilot. I'm like, if you're going to do this, you got to stay focused and you got to do it. And he was having managers, they'll go off. So we were kind of like lingering, just going, ugh. And I just realized in that time, I'm going to write a screenplay and I'm going to get it made before this guy does. Right. That was my evil thought. That was it. Okay.
It was almost like I want to stick it to this guy and show him that yes, I can do this.
Oh, I still want to stick it to him. Okay. I'm sure he knows that the movie's out and he knows I'm sticking it to him. So I had this idea, which was basically the idea of, you know, how technology changed in 30 years. Mm-hmm. And then pot was legal. And then I thought, wait a minute, wouldn't it be funny if we had guys that started in like 86, smoked some weed, and they're you know, in 47-year-old bodies with 17-year-old brains, the world has changed completely. Google, Craigslist, every, you know, how you date, Facebook, and pot's legal. And I thought that was an interesting answer. I was like, okay. And so that's how, that's where I started.
Because I was thinking, like, in terms of time travel, that, you know, people are saying, like, oh, you go back to
I hate time 40s, travel 30s, movies, by like the way.
But just in the sense where it's like, if somebody even just like, you know, just from like, it's just like the 80s, whether they came forward to today or somebody that was just like a teenager now right. went back to the 80s.
Well, I like Back to the Future. Yeah, I love Back to the Future as it. But like any of yeah. those other time travel, hot tub time travel, I mean, I've been compared to that and stuff like that. Because but we're moving forward.
Yes.
You know, we start in 86 and get to 2016. Okay. So that's what they're more fish out of water. So I like that idea. I like the idea of these guys, that these man-child, these guys that were in these bodies, but their brains hadn't developed past 17 years old, and pot was legal.
And
the internet, and what the fuck is going on here, right?
So for you, tapping into that, I mean, growing up, maybe pretty much present day during that time, relating to a lot of the stuff that you've got Reeves and Harris that are interested in and wanting to be about. So it was easy just to kind of dial into Reeves and Harris's characters.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it was man. It was like those guys were like, they had great ideas. They wanted to sell coffee in 86, okay? Yeah,
that's right.
They wanted to sell coffee. Like, and that, they were told that was the stupidest idea. That's like selling bottled water, which was another stupid idea that was brought up in 86. Only look, you know, look what bottled water is doing today. We have Starbucks on every, you know, we have a coffee shop on at least three on every street in L.A., you know, so yeah, they had these kind of ideas. They were just kind of bugling along a little bit, you know, and I just thought it would be just so funny to see how the world would change, how it's just changed. Somebody said, is it your life? I'm saying, what? I was stoned and comatose for 30 years. No, I've done some things.
Yeah.
I didn't wake up. Hello, world.
But just in terms of who Reeves and Harris were back in the 86, was it very similar to you or just friends of yours that you're kind
they're of friends of mine. They were friends of mine. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, yeah. It was, we were going to the LL Cool J, Beastie Boys. LL Cool J and Run DMC concert. Now, it was actually a concert. I forget the name of what they called it in that summer and stuff like that.
Oh, wow. Yeah, because yeah. I guess, you know, because they both got the big glasses that they're all.
Oh, yeah, the Adidas. Oh, yeah, that's the whole, the shell toes. The, yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah. That I did have the shell toes, of course.
The what you've done with Reeves's hair back in 86. That is a sweet hairstyle.
Okay.
On top of that.
That actually came from a drunken night with Big Daddy Kane. He actually sings the title song Ripped with, I put him together with Lance Herbstrong, not Armstrong. Look him up. Herbstrong. And they're this kind of techno live band that they can merge. They're fantastic. So, and they're in Austin. They were an Austin band, right? And so with Big Daddy, they came together, but that was after the fact. I had met Big Daddy Kane at Russell Peters' house, and Russell said, "You guys got to meet." And so Big Daddy Kane, he was drinking some wine, and we were getting there, and he said, "What kind of hairstyle are you gonna get Faze on?" I'm like, you know, that's so funny you say that because I don't want to do the typical Afro thing. I mean, that's just so stupid. And he goes, "Gumby that shit." I'm like, what? Gumby that shit. You know, Gumby. And like, you know, the Gumby hair and all that. And like, I had it. Like, kid and play. And I'm like, perfect. Done. So, Big Daddy Kane.
I never realized that was the name of that kind of style was the Gumby.
Gumby. Yeah, Gumby.
I didn't realize that. All right. Yeah,
Gumby it. Gumby that shit. And I'm like, what? I was like, I knew Pokey. Well, Gumby that shit.
So you mentioned Faison. Was he somebody that you had in mind right from the beginning? Or was that something that you had to
buy? I was aware of Faison. It was really, you know, I've always loved him. And it was interesting. It was Russell and I had a conversation, and Russell knew him. And they were interesting friends. And I thought, this could be good because I think when you see the movie, you see the relationship between the two of them. What I also wanted to accomplish was a trust. And I think you have to, that's an incredible thing that I really learned in comedy. You need to have your actors trust you, and you need to make them feel comfortable, especially when you're going to push things to the absurd, mm-hmm. you know, and which I do and something like that. And they trust it, you know, and so Faison. with Russell just made sense to me because I knew within the scene, as long as we got what we got, and we always would get what we needed, and then I would let it roll because I knew that these two guys could power off each other. And they did. And they powered off each other in a really kind of great way, some of that stuff. Some of that funnier lines I will give to Faison. Yes. And Russell.
What I do like, though, is it kind of goes, because you expect maybe more of the cliche thing, is where you have two buddies, and eventually they have to have this terrible disagreement, and they kind of go their separate ways, only to reunite. And it's nice that they are just, they're there for each other throughout the entire film.
Right.
I mean, a couple of hiccups along the way, but overall, right. I mean, they're there. Right. And so I like that idea of, it's like, all right, there's no big, it avoided the cliche of, like, this tremendous, you know, obstacle that they need to overcome just personally.
Right. I didn't want them smoking, like, going, dude. You know, I tried to avoid most of those dudes. I have a couple of dudes, but not, you know, kind of a stoner. You know, my other favorite movie would have to be Fast Times at Ridgemont High. I mean, Sean Penn is probably, that was probably him and Keanu and Alex Winter in Bill and Ted. So those are some great stoners.
And what, Faison worked with Ken, what is it, in the
oh, Faison was in Elf.
Yes.
Yes, yes. He plays that crazy.
He's
brilliant. He is brilliant, and I learned a lot from him. He's a challenging actor, and I like it.
So for you, as somebody who's written the script, and then you turn it over to the actors to give them, do you give them a lot of leeway in terms of improvising, or do you kind of basically, let's do one to the script, and then I'll give you guys a chance?
We talk about it. I'm not precious. You know, I'm like, oh, you got to say that word. You know, you got to say that word.
You don't understand.
Although I've heard the whole Terminator story with Arnold Schwarzenegger, I'll be back. And Arnold kept saying, we'll be back. And James Cameron is, no, I'll be back. You know, I'll be back. And they were fighting. And they got in the hugest fight, I think. And of course, one of the greatest lines is, I'll be back, right? So yeah, we have a conversation of getting what we need to get, and I do like let it. I think the most amazing thing of digital is that you can let it roll. I think my biggest disappointment for Dan in real life as a producer was some of the funniest stuff would happen when the film rolled out, and you know, so you lose all of that.
Yeah,
you lose a lot of that stuff, but.
Yeah, digitally. Yeah,
digitally, you can just keep going.
But what does that mean for when you get into the editing room and you've let everything roll, and now you've got, for a scene, you could have just so many hours of footage,
right.
And you've got to distill it down to something.
You just have to figure it out. It's painless. I mean, it's painful. It's painful. It's painful because there's some stuff that even was so brilliant, but the problem was you're moving at such a fast pace sometimes, and. I never got the reverse of it because it was never really scripted.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't think of it sometimes of getting the reverse, because if you had the reverse, then you could have added some of the, some crazy, I mean, I get some of it, but some of the stuff you would miss out on. Yeah.
So now you said you shot this in Austin?
Yeah.
All right. So it's certainly not the south of France, but Austin, a very cool town.
Oh, I've never been to Austin. I love Austin. It's the greatest city. I mean, it's fantastic. I would encourage everybody to move to Austin.
And what made you decide to head out to Austin?
I had the tax credit. It was right to work state, and it fit what we needed. And I can make it nondescript. I mean, you don't really know it. Most people don't know it's Austin.
No, I would not have thought about that.
So I made it over stoner, whatever. Let's hope that, you know, how many states we got now, you know, next election will be more, unless Jeff Sessions has his way. It's all right.
How long did you have in Austin to shoot this?
20 days.
So I mean,
moving quick.
When, you know, for working on other, you know, big budget productions where you've got, you know, sometimes months to be able to shoot this project. Now you've got 20 days. Is it hard to kind of scale back and work within that time frame?
It's like hard. It's challenging. You know what I mean? I'm complaining. I get to make movies. It's challenging when, and I love that. How do you convey what you're trying to do on a limited budget or something? So, yeah, those were those challenges and stuff like that. And then moving so quickly. I mean, Jesus, 10 pages a day, 12 pages a day, sometimes three moves in a day. And my producer, see, that's the stupidity producer of me. Oh, we can get it done. And my producer's like, no, you can't. You can't. I'm like, yes, we can. And I did it. I did. And with that, you know, I should have listened to her on that one. You know, but it didn't matter. I mean, we only had 20 days. It wasn't like I was going to get an extra day. It was an independent movie. Hey, you know, I don't have that luxury.
As somebody that's worked on both sides, on independent productions as well as studio productions, just in terms of just like the scale of it, is there... I guess the question is like a lot of just unnecessary fat on
waste.
A studio production.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where you're just like doing it something more independent. It's actually just, you know, you can see that a lot of, there's money wasted unnecessarily so on a big studio production.
I think there is. I think there's a lot of way. I think, well, it's just the way the American system in filmmaking is set up. You have to have a certain amount of number of drivers. If you have the cars, if you have a certain amount of, you know, grip and electric and stuff like that. But there's a way, I think, to scale down if you have a really good crew to do that. I mean, that's the only way. You have to find people that are going to go on this suicide mission with you. Because you're asking the DP who hates you, right? You're going to shoot this movie in 20 days. Now, he's great, Phil Roy, and I think he did a spectacular job. But I'm sure Phil said, oh, I wish I had 40 days. Of course. Well, any DP is going to say that, right? Yeah.
So for you, day one, I'm sure it's like, oh, we got 20 days. Are we going to be able to get everything that we need to get done?
Is Faison going to show up? Okay, because he hadn't arrived yet. That was our day. Okay, so
Day one, Faison
was on a... he came in that morning. He had to do a stand-up that night before. His agents were capable of booking him because that's where they make his money. I'm like, no. We have a contract. He was supposed to be here 2 weeks ago, right? But they had, at that point, what are you supposed to do? And we had already had one day of rehearsal, so I was well prepared. and Faison, Faison shows up and all that, and I put the Gumby on his head. I put that shirt and that jacket and those pants, and he looks at me, and I go, next time maybe show up a little earlier, and you can have a say in this, but you don't. Let's go! Let's shoot, baby! He was such a trooper with that outfit. I mean, it was kind of a really like, are you kidding me? Like, imagine arriving, right? And I put him in, and that's the first outfit. You're in the 80, you're in 2016 look.
Yeah, with the 86 clothes.
With the 86 clothes that don't fit. Right, and it's 110 degrees out, And we're getting into the van to shoot that first scene in the van where Debbie knocks on, and that was the first scene with them.
Man, was he there for all 20 days, or did he also have to fly out and do stand-up?
No,
that was
I think Russell had to shoot 1 or 2 days and maybe Faison, but we were able to keep it to, like, comedians usually, they make their most money on Thursday, Friday, starting Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday kind of thing.
How many days into production did you feel comfortable, like, all right, we're going to be able to get it done, 20 days?
Oh, I always felt we were going to get it done.
Really?
Oh, yeah. There was no. Like, I'm getting it done. Like, that's who I am. Like, no, I'll get it done. Like, there's a wall. I'll barrel through that wall. I have to get it done.
That's right. Yeah, I guess at the end of the day.
My Teamsters didn't show up one day because they thought it was a big thing. It was like, and it was the farthest location. And I'm like, and we're going to shoot that scene. We had to shoot the Bucky scene and all that stuff inside and outside, the bathroom scene. I show up. And I'm like, I see some crew, but I don't see, where are our trucks? And I can see my producer slowly coming over to me, just going, I'm like, am I here early? She goes, no, we have an issue. And I'm like, oh, where are our trucks? That's the issue. And they had the makeup trucks and all that. So she was able to wrangle everybody, get all the makeup kits out of the thing. She hired a hotel, opened a hotel like 2 blocks away from where we were. We were up and running and got it done in that day in the same amount of hours. I just lost hours to shoot, but I had to get it done.
For you, being under those kind of restrictions and those kind of obstacles, does it excite you as opposed to, it'd be great to be on a big studio production, have all the money, have all this stuff?
I love it.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just a sick human being. That way. Like, I like to torture myself. Like, I mean, I've lost my key to my car. That's in my car, okay? I have two car keys, right? Now, I could easily, no one's been able to find it. I just like to torture myself for 3 years. And, like, if I just go get another key, my life will be easy, right? But I just want to torture myself because I know when I find that key and when I buy that key, I'm going to see that key that same day, the spare key.
That's true. Like that.
I've sent it to the dealership. They're like, no, we can't find it. The key is definitely in the car because you can start the car. So anybody who knows me and lives here and sees my car, you can actually steal it because
the key's in there.
Well, the key's in it, but you need the other key to actually open it. But if it's unlocked, you guys are good to go.
I mean, nobody's watched Brad. What kind of car do you
it's
have?
It's an Infiniti.
Oh, yeah, okay, great. License plate number?
Yeah, 2L5.
So now, as you finish there with Ripped, and you get in post, and you're putting it up, I guess, as I say, like, there's three different movies that you're making. You what you're writing, what you're shooting, and then what you're editing.
Right.
So which was the more enjoyable step for that?
I think the most enjoyable was obviously shooting the movie and stuff like that. I think the editing, you beat yourself up and go, God damn it, I wish I would have gotten that shot. But I did bring my editor. I brought her to Austin with me. Yeah, because I just felt that was my producing instinct, like spend the money, put your editor there. She was editing everything as we were going along. So if I missed something, I could grab it if I needed to. And it was helpful.
Because I've heard like Kevin Smith things where for some of his films, he starts editing right along the way. So that's got to be so helpful.
Yeah.
To know if you've missed something.
It's exhausting, but I think it's the smart thing to do. Other filmmakers don't even want to get into that.
Because I'd imagine, because if you miss something, then you have to try to, if you can scrunch up more money to try to do a reshoot, which I imagine on that kind of budget, it's impossible.
But, you know, that's the mentality of the studio thing, is that that's part of it. Is that, we'll go back and get it. Oh, if it doesn't really work, we'll reshoot, 30 pages, $30 million.
And instead, why don't we just, shoot it the right way the first time and not have to worry about all that?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, you've seen it. And you've interviewed a lot of people where they've started out with something and they've gone over budget or something, or they tested the movie and it, something didn't work, or they hated the character. I mean, there's been some famous stories about, I think it was Michael Eisner told me once when he did, they got horrible ratings on Grease, the musical, right?
Oh, wow.
And Michael Eisner was the guy that came up and he told me this. He said, animate the credits at the beginning. So basically it was animated. It was trying to get your, the one thing I've always learned from him was like, get your audience comfortable at whatever you're going to do. So when they screened it the first time, it was a musical and people weren't into it. But when they showed the animation at the beginning, people got into it. So when the music came up, and they were singing and dancing, it scored huge.
Oh, that's all right. Yeah. As we're getting to a wrap up, the one thing I want to ask, because there is a lot of pot smoking in this film, but when you're actually shooting pot when you're actually trying to recreate pot smoking,
Pot.
Yeah, is it?
No.
No. I'm like, all right, but
it's some good OG dude and some Tiva, No, it's all natural stuff that the prop department gets. I mean, there's a whole thing of all of, things that you can smoke for, it's just natural. It's like vaping in a way, what I mean? So the actors doesn't feel like they're, I'm sure 20 years ago they were definitely taking some horrible shit, like just use this tobacco or something. It's got, we'll just spray some stuff. It's carcinogenic.
So props is coming to you going like, this is how it's going to look. And you want to just kind of see how the effect is like, that looks like it's realistic kind of pot.
Yeah. I mean, it's a pot. Yeah, exactly. And the funny thing about it was like, they would bring me some of the, we have weed in there and jars and all that. And they were showing me the weeds. And I was just like, no. It's just like, where'd you guys grow up? Like, they had brown weed. I said, no, I grew up with purple and specky weed.
Guys, come on. Do your research. What is happening here? Yes.
Yeah.
So now going through this whole process, Ripped is done. It's now available to be seen by audiences finally.
Yeah.
Are you, do you feel like, all right, you've crossed the finish line, so
yes,
to speak. Are you happy with the results? Are you excited to jump back in and work on the next project?
I'm excited to work on the next project. I'm already on to the next one. We're about to cast it. And so it's something I wrote with another writer, female writer, a friend of mine. And we're going to just do that. And then I have another one that goes into the south of France, actually.
Mate. Is it easy to kind of let that, because you feel like you hear like George Lucas. I mean, somebody like, with the Star Wars films or something like that, you're kind of obsessive and kind of like, what didn't I get? And kind of noodling. Are you able to kind of put that aside and say,
I have obsessed over all the things that I need to have my conversation with myself on how to be a better director and how to do things differently and better. I've had those conversations and beat myself up with now. And I'm excited to take that knowledge and screw it up on the next one. No. And make it happen on the next one. So yeah, I'm done with this. I've learned. I'm appreciative of everything, and I'm excited. I hope people, go out and see the movie. It's fun. Download it on Apple. I think it's so amazing. Like, you get an Apple, it's like on a PlayStation. I'm like, PlayStation? What do you mean? You can download on PlayStation and all that. So it's available now. I'm not going to tell people to smoke weed and watch it.
But if you find yourself,
yourself in that situation, it's always enjoyable.
So, Brad, if they want to keep up to date with you, I know you've got a cool Instagram handle. Where can they follow you on social media to keep up to date on Ripped or any of the future projects?
I would say go to Instagram. It's Panther Films, and Twitter. It's Epstein Brad.
Man, and, you know, if you need somebody to, you know, just keep an eye on just the gear in the south of France, just let me know.
You know, you're on.
Right? Yeah, sure. Yeah, there you go.
You know, suntan lotion. You want to be the suntanner?
That's right. That's perfect. Yep, guys.
Suntanner, bring him in.
Guys, you know, you want to cover every part of your body. You don't get melanoma, guys. Let me be that person.
And by that, the production over there, don't they have, like, French hours where they just keep, you keep working, but they just serve the most amazing food at all times. You
the crest service must be amazing over there.
Yes. No Twizzlers.
You're going to be able to find out firsthand about that.
Yes.
We may never see you return back to the States.
I'm not coming back. I have had French hours. I'm telling you, those most important thing on the set is the caterer, my friend.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because I feel like a happy
crew.
Yes.
I will always spend more money on catering, always to keep the crew happy. These people work their fucking asses off.
Oh, that's what I like to hear. Because if they're full and
they have
happy
families too, and they need to get home to their families too, so that's like I'm respectful of what they do.
Oh man! My guest today has been Brad Epstein. Make sure you checked out Ripped. Be on the lookout for not one but two upcoming films.
Let's hope more than two. But
wait, okay. Yes, but we'll just start with two at least in the pipeline. Yes, we'll say two in the pipeline.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. There you go. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I've been your host Frank Moran. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Happy Go Jackie. Folks, we'll see you back here next time for another episode of iTalk Movies right here on Popcorn Talk.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network. The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.